A 13-year-old boy stands at Shinagawa Station in 1960, watching his best friend Lion push through a cheering crowd.
"Are you really going?"
Lion asks, tears streaming down his face. The boy promises to write, to return someday. But as the train pulls away toward a ship bound for North Korea, the supposed paradise on Earth, he knows he'll never see his friend again. What follows is 36 years of hell that would test the limits of human endurance and expose one of the 20th century's cruelest deceptions. Masaji Ishikawa's journey into darkness began with a campaign of lies. In the late 1950s, the General Association of Korean Residents in Japan launched a Return to North Korea movement, though most Koreans in Japan had never set foot there. The propaganda was relentless. Free education, stable jobs, a better life. What really convinced people wasn't grand ideology, but simple promises, enough food, dignity, opportunity. Japan wanted to rid itself of Koreans they feared might cause unrest. Kim Il-sung needed workers to rebuild after the Korean War. Together, they orchestrated a mass migration that would trap over 93,000 people in a totalitarian nightmare. When Ishikawa's ship approached Cheongjin Port, he saw only barren mountains. An elderly passenger clutched the rail, his face ashen. "This isn't what I expected."
It was already too late.
Born in 1947 to a Korean father and Japanese mother, Ishikawa lived between worlds, Japanese by birth, yet marked as different. His early years held simple joys, floating in irrigation canals, catching beetles, dreaming of helping others. But darkness lived at home. His father, Do Samdal, kidnapped from Korea at 14 to work in a Japanese munitions factory, was rough and alcoholic, regularly beating Ishikawa's mother while the children cowered helplessly. His grandmother whispered, "You're a kind boy. Don't be like your father," while his uncles called Koreans barbarians. The worst night came when Ishikawa was 12. His drunken father forced his mother at knife point up a quarried aisle and pushed her over the edge. Young Masaji jumped down after her, finding her bloodied but alive. He helped her to a hospital, then to the train station where she fled, promising to return. She never did. This traumatic childhood forged a resilience Ishikawa would desperately need in the years ahead.
Their first meal, dog meat so foul they couldn't eat it, foreshadowed everything to come. After weeks in a reception center, they reached Dongcheongri Village, a place with feeble electric lights, but no gas or running water. Ishikawa's 6-year-old sister fell into the snow, wailing, "I want to go home." From day one, Ishikawa faced discrimination as a Japanese bastard. Students mocked his plastic shoes and watch while whispering insults. When he intervened in a schoolyard fight, a uniformed man beat him until his mouth bled. Despite his academic achievements, he was classified as hostile class, the lowest caste, simply because of his Japanese background. An official bluntly told him, "The son of a farmer must be a farmer," crushing his dreams of studying physics. The promised year's supply of rice turned out to be mostly corn and low-grade cereals. Neighbors were grouped in units of 5 families, with leaders reporting everything to the secret police. When a hollow-cheeked policeman caught Ishikawa adding fallen rice grains to pig feed, he berated him, "Rice is for humans, you little shit." His father punched the officer, but was marched away at gunpoint. He returned at midnight with a bloody, swollen face, the first time Ishikawa had ever seen his father frightened.
In April 1964, their house burned down on Kim Il-sung's birthday after a drunk guest fell asleep with a lit cigarette. Officials who'd enjoyed their hospitality called them Japanese bastards, but generously allowed them to cut trees for a new home. While cutting trees, his father insisted Ishikawa eat both rice balls their mother had prepared. When they fell in the mud and his father retrieved them, he burst into tears, a shocking display that made Ishikawa feel closer to him than ever before. The years brought cascading losses. In 1966, his grandmother's death in Japan devastated his mother, aging her overnight.
Ishikawa fell in love with Rim Suyan, but her mother refused to let her daughter marry a Japanese returnee. At 23, he entered an arranged marriage that quickly collapsed. His wife fled, returned pregnant, and left shortly after their son Hocho was born in March 1972. 2 months later, Ishikawa's mother collapsed. Her last words asked him to take her ashes to Japan. He stole pants from a clothesline to dress her properly, only to discover they were equally ratty. He buried her on a mountainside, placing a cigarette on her grave instead of incense, singing Red Dragonfly, the children's song she used to sing while looking at the sky that connected her to Japan.
Kim Il-sung's unexpected death on July 8, 1994, left Ishikawa crying alongside co-workers. After 30 years under Il-sung's reign of terror, the brainwashing had penetrated deeper than he realized. But the real catastrophe was just beginning. Since 1991, severe weather had devastated North Korea's fragile agricultural system. The official distribution promised 1.5 pounds of grain daily, but they received only 1 pound of 70% cornstarch. People stretched 3 days' worth of food across 2 weeks. The year 1995 marked the beginning of what North Koreans called the Arduous March. Children too weak for school roamed streets searching for anything edible. Ishikawa watched helplessly as his children Myunghwa and Hosun grew skeletal, their eyes unnaturally large in gaunt faces. Death became commonplace. Corpses lay unclaimed in streets. Catastrophic floods destroyed South Pyongan province's grain production, effectively ending government food distribution. Ishikawa's family subsisted on foraged acorns through winter. When spring came, they boiled wild weeds, which caused severe swelling and chronic diarrhea. Dark rumors of cannibalism circulated. By September 1996, looking at his emaciated family, Ishikawa made a desperate decision. If death was inevitable, he might as well die attempting to reach Japan, where he could send money to save his family.
Without travel documents, Ishikawa sneaked onto Hamju Station's platform, tearing his pants and cutting his knees. He grabbed the moving train's ladder, then climbed through a broken window to the roof, clinging to a ventilation grill through the rain-soaked journey. After jumping off before Haesan to avoid checks, he walked toward the Yalu River, just 30 yards separating North Korea from China. For 3 days he survived on scraps while studying the guards' routines, growing weaker and haunted by visions of his family. On the third night during torrential rain, when guards vanished, he threw himself into the raging river. He awoke to see a distant light. Too weak to walk, he crawled toward it before passing out. An elderly Korean man named Kim carried him to safety and nursed him back to health. After recovering, he contacted the Japanese Red Cross, who connected him with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. On October 15, 1996, after 36 years, Masaji Ishikawa finally returned to Japan.
Japan's promised salvation crumbled immediately. The ministry shuffled Ishikawa between hotels and apartments before dumping him in an alcoholic rehabilitation center. Officials begged him not to speak to journalists. Parliament members showed no interest. He couldn't find work. His mother's relatives rejected him. The government that claimed people like him left of their own free will abandoned him completely. The cruelest blow, his wife had starved despite his money transfers. His daughter Myunghwa died in her late 20s. He lost contact with his son Hosan in 1998. His promise to rescue his family remained unfulfilled, not through his failure, but through political indifference. Ishikawa's story reveals more than North Korea's brutality. It exposes the complicity of nations that turned away. His memoir stands as testimony. Paradise promised by liars is always hell in disguise. Behind every North Korean statistic lie real lives and deaths like his family's. His survival demands we remember them and never mistake propaganda for truth.